BTC Pay right now, our main focus is focus on what we call the Bitcoin service provider. So what we see is that there is a lot of local community in Bitcoin world. But the problem is that when a merchant or somebody is really interested, then they're missing somebody that can take their hands and guide them, or somebody to call. And when you are taking care of a community, you don't want to do this because, like, you're not paid for that. You know, it's not so you don't want to commit to this, and like, people are kind of left in the cold. So in BTC Pay Server, like, we are trying to these days work to create new feature, new tooling for those Bitcoin service provider, while giving them a way to make money out of it.
Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. In this episode, I talk with Nicolas Dorier, founder and maintainer of BTC Pay Server, as well as nBitcoin Library. We talk about the BTC Pay Server roadmap for the coming year, including Bitcoin service provider functions and the bigger vision for the platform. We also discuss Nicolas' experience going through the block size war and how it prompted the development of BTC Pay Server, his approach to assessing proposed changes to Bitcoin, and how he gets his technical information. We also talk about the impact of transaction fees and Layer 2 solutions. If you have any questions or would like to reach out, my emails are always open, hello@thetransformationofvalue.com. If you want to support the show, please consider leaving a review or boosting some sats via your favorite podcasting 2.0 platform. Otherwise, on to the show. Alrighty, we're recording.
Perfect.
It's been quite cold the last few days.
Yep.
You're living in Tokyo?
Nicole. Yeah, I'm living in Tokyo.
Yeah,
I came back from a trip to the north of Japan. We did some ski. So,
are you into skiing?
Yeah, but actually, I'm colder here because I'm less equipped.
How long have you been in Japan for?
2015.
So, oh wow,
yeah, 8 years something.
What sort of made the move?
I've been to several times as a tourist in Japan, and like, I feel a great place to live. And at the time, I could get a working holiday visa to stay longer here. So I decided, okay, I would try for 1 year and a half. If I find a job, I can get a sponsor and like stay longer. And like, yeah, I just came and finally find a way to get a sponsor.
Yeah. So, originally, what sort of work were you doing when you came over on the working holiday?
I was already working for Bitcoin at the time. A bit before Bitcoin, I was mainly a trainer, .NET trainer. So I would go to companies. I had lots of certification from Microsoft, and I would teach them how to code, basically.
Yeah.
Then I discovered Bitcoin, created this library in Bitcoin. That is kind of a way for me to learn is often coding something, re-implementing it. So I started with this. And a bit later, like when I joined, like I was working with in a company with somebody, I don't know if you know in Switzerland, BT, does it ring a bell? So before BT was not a broker exchange like they are doing, they had another model with retail card, but they completely pivoted. So I was working with them at the time, and then later to another company called MetaCore, you know, around this space as well.
Yeah, so that original open source library you worked on was nBitcoin, is that right?
nBitcoin,
C# library.
Yeah.
And then you were working on that. And then how did you come up with BTC Pay Server? Like, how did that story come about?
Well, it took a while. So I started working in Bitcoin, I think 2014, maybe something like this, a bit after MTGOX. Then I work on nBitcoin, and BTC Pay came over during the block size war in 2017. And there was a fight between big blocker and small blocker, and like basically the big businesses tried to change Bitcoin, and most of the community didn't wanted that. Even the miners kind of side with the companies. And yeah, at the time, it was the only time where I fear about Bitcoin, basically. You know, I never got scared about anything about Bitcoin, except this time where I was a bit scary.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. I mean, that was a bit before my time, but I read the great book, The Block Size War, that sort of details that blow by blow, and seeing the way the different factions sort of emerged and the different ways the narratives kind of came about. And in a way, Tokyo was sort of a bit of a hub. And obviously Hong Kong as well was where, you know, these meetings took place. But there was a lot of these kind of different people coming together, and as you say, the corporate influence of the miners, different parties, and that sort of led to you looking at the options for Bitcoin payments, right?
Yeah, like the problem was Bitcoin, even if the base protocol is decentralized, if it's too hard to use. Here's a big problem with Bitcoin, and it's not easy to solve. I think it's solvable, but not easy to solve. But if it's not easy enough to use, then people start relying in custodial model to make it easier. So these days we have that, for example, with Wallet of Satoshi typically, but like at the time it was way worse. Like everybody that wanted to accept payment was using, for example, BitPay. So it was way worse than before, and you end up in this situation that because you want ease of use, you put yourself in a position that is quite fragile and weak to this kind of corporate takeover, I would call that. And when I saw that, basically I say, okay, like one thing I would just want to make BitPay obsolete, because I thought really they were also not frank to their merchant about that. They were saying, oh, you don't have to do anything. The upgrade will be automatic. They were kind of hiding to their customer. So it was kind of a very, how can I say, very sneaky. And yeah, I decided to work on BTC Pay at this time to try to get people self-sovereign again, basically.
So the original BTC Pay server, was that an original code base? Was that forked from an existing project?
No. It was done from scratch.
Yeah.
What was forked? So BitPay had a few integration in several e-commerce websites in the form of plugin. So in from the BTC Pay source code, so that I wrote from scratch, it's not a fork. I replicated the same API as BitPay. So by doing that, I could just fork their plugin as well, and it would just work on my project basically. And after it became way easier to migrate people, because there was lots of people that was pissed off at BitPay. And when you tell them, okay, you don't have to change any code, nothing in your process, you just have to point one URL from one to another, or like to just change the plugin, like they will do it. It was very easy. So it's kind of how like BTC Pay bootstrapped itself. Yeah.
Yeah. And coming back to the BitPay piece, that was a closed source project. Do you think that was part of the problem as well, that they were trying to build this thing and we didn't know what was going on inside? Or
So BitPay was a closed source project, yeah. We didn't know what was inside. I mean, like, even if they were open, I think I would have wrote it from scratch. So yeah. I'm a C# developer, so it means that, you know, we often hear like developers should choose the best tool for the job, but like when you spend your life working on a specific tool, you are like 10 or 100 times more productive using that tool. So it's more, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, you know, we're talking about payments here, and I don't know if you saw over the last few days, there was a bit of an incident with Stripe deplatforming BitSaga, and they were selling mining hardware and a few different things. And it's kind of blown up on X, looking at, you know, he's just selling these computers basically, and he's being deplatformed from Stripe. Are you seeing the kind of use case of BTC Pay Server more and more relevant when that stuff starts to clamp down?
Yeah, definitely. But lots of people, initially what happened when they are deplatformized is like, oh, we say, oh, look, BTC Pay Server, and they say, hey, it doesn't solve my problem. I want fiat conversion. But like, good luck finding somebody that accepts you. So at the end of the day, they are like facing the wall, and they will take the easiest path. And the easiest path is hosting your own server. Mm-hmm. And of course, that means that it will change their process, their mindset. They will need to be maybe custody of their own Bitcoin. Maybe they will need to sell every week to an exchange. So there is work on their side. But like when you're faced in front of a wall, they don't really have choice.
Yeah, there's certainly two islands of kind of the fiat world and the Bitcoin world, and the bridges between them are the challenge, right? And so I've been very interested in emerging conversations around, say, federated solutions or things that enable semi-custodial services to be operated in a way where they're not at the whims of the state as a sort of a middle solution for a lot of people. I mean, Wallet of Satoshi is the perfect example. It's effectively been pulled out of the US market. And it was recommended by a lot of people to use. And the single point of failure was the Apple App Store.
Yeah.
Whereas if you could run a solution like that in a way where there wasn't that choke point of an App Store or a mobile Play Store kind of thing.
So it's just a bit what we are working on in BTCP right now. So BTCP right now, our main focus is focus on what we call the Bitcoin service provider. So what we see is that there is a lot of local community in Bitcoin world. But the problem is that when a merchant or somebody is really interested, then they're missing somebody that can take their hands and guide them or somebody to call. And when you are taking care of a community, you don't want to do this because you're not paid for that. You don't want to commit to this. And people are kind of left in the cold. So in BTCP server, we are trying to these days work to create new feature, new tooling for those Bitcoin service provider while giving them a way to make money out of it. And we find a way, it's non-custodial in the sense that the user has these keys, but it's custodial in a way where we want that the Bitcoin service providers host the infrastructure for people, that them board. So for example, merchant or something like this, basically they are kind of a LSP of the people they onboard. And if they go down, then our goal is that the merchants with the BTCP app, mobile app we are working on, will be able to just connect to somebody else, infrastructure to pull out their money. So we try to reach this model, this hybrid. It's still non-custodial because we don't want to put the Bitcoin service provider in a legal risk. And we don't want to put the merchant in legal risk. So the goal is really the key stays with the merchant. They cannot be rug pulled. And if the BSP go down, then they can go to somebody else. And I think that's the best model we can hope.
Yeah.
And but it really pass. So this model, I think, as well, can be profitable for a Bitcoin service provider because if they host the infrastructure, they can take, for example, routing fees on Lightning Network, but they can do also service providing kind of stable coin, with what we call stable channel in Lightning. I don't know if you heard about it, but basically, if they both have an agreement, they say, okay, imagine the merchant say, oh, I want you protect me against the volatility of Bitcoin. What they can do is that every 5 minutes, they settle the difference of price between them. It means that if the BSP disappear, the merchant is fine. He's not edged anymore, but he didn't lose any money. So we are trying to push this model because it's also a source of potential revenue for BSP.
Yeah.
There is lots of work to do on this, so it's very early,
yeah.
But it's kind of the direction we're trying to take.
Yeah, and you talk about BTC Pay Server is an open source project. In terms of contributors to this project, how many people are working on the project at the moment?
So I guess in the people that we pay, we should be maybe 8-9, something like this.
Yeah. So you've got paid contributors?
Yes. So I established the BTC Pay Server Foundation. It's hosted in Japan. And we receive corporate donations. So OpenSats, Kraken, we got Bailey Gifford, many, many others. Spiral, we got very lucky.
Yeah.
And it's enough to fund developers. On my side, I'm also supported by DigiLab. So it's a company in Japan as well. I'm an employee in DigiLab, but everything I do for my work is working on BTC Pay Server. So it's really kind of stealth supporter in a way.
Yeah. What is DigiLab's main line of business?
So DigiLab is a company that is it's called they call that a research lab, and they had like different team like AI, biotech, blockchain, VR, and it's kind of research lab. So they funded some Bitcoin contributors, and but on my side they just let me work on BTCV server. So it's exactly what I'm doing.
It sounds like
they are very supportive for Bitcoin. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Very glad.
So you've got this team of people. You're working on obviously some new initiatives. I mean, what does the process look like within BTC Pay Server for road mapping the project and like what you want to do next? Like how do you make that happen? Is it through the foundation? You have conversations or?
Yeah, so most of the time we have conversation mainly with Rockstar Dev, Pavel Nex and Cooks about kind of the direction, and in general there is not much disagreement. Like we're kind of all on the same page, and we don't have too long-term vision because things are changing quick in Bitcoin, you know. So the way we are doing is, in general, we have kind of a vision of what we want the next major release to be. And we have one major release every 2 or 3 months. So we have some kind of big feature that we have in mind that we want to do for next time. And on top of that, we between major release, we are releasing like minor release. And in general, it's like small bug fixes, like adjustment of the slight adjustment of the UX, and this is maybe every 1 or 2 weeks we make a new release.
Yeah.
And there is also an emergency release after a major release when there is lots of code then moved, and if things blow up, we need to fix it quick.
Yeah.
But it's not too long term. Like this direction I said about the Bitcoin service provider, I think it's like for the next 1-2 years it will be kind of the focus, but further than this I don't know how it will be.
I got a question for you. So how does the current narrative around high fees on chain, what we've seen over the last few months, how does that affect some of the core thought processes that go into BTC Pay Server in terms of merchants using it for on-chain Bitcoin? Has that changed the way you look at it as a product?
So the two main things that changed with those high fees, one is that we want to prioritize RBF feature in our wallets for next big major release. And also like we found out that the fees estimation from Bitcoin Core are way off as of what people expect. So we kind of now use the mempool space API to get that. And I think we should do better and not rely on an external API, but like it was kind of the short-term fix that we needed to put. But except this, like it doesn't really change anything. Yeah.
Interesting. So do you have much to do with Bitcoin Core in terms of sharing ideas or conversing with them? Or?
Oh, not really. Like I contributed a bit on Core a long time ago, but it's still, you know, C++. I'm not very productive on this. And then every PR in Bitcoin Core need it's like 20% of code and 80% of talking with people to try to get it done, to get it merged. So it's like it can be frustrating. I don't think there is real solution to it. It's a big project, important project. People are cautious. So I'm not. That's why I'm not working directly on Bitcoin Core anymore.
So when did you stop working on Core?
When I started or stopped?
When you stopped.
I don't know. I didn't do that much, but I think maybe 2018 or something like this, my last pull request. I don't really remember.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I mean, how do you see the pathway for people contributing to projects? I mean, you've got, you know, some really good people working on a BTC Pay Server. There's, I guess, more of an ecosystem for grants and people to actually get paid for this work as well. How are you seeing that landscape for open source contribution?
So we are kind of lucky. We have been the first project in Bitcoin community to be funded and to have the chance to focus on that. I don't know if there is really a process. So it, for new contributor in BTC Pay Server, we are trying to make issues that we tag with good first issues so people can dip their toes on the good source code on that. But it's really as a newcomer, I would say like use BTC Pay Server, find something that's broken and try to fix it by yourself. And by doing that, maybe the first time, just fixing your typo will take you 2 hours to just fix the typo because you need to learn a bunch of things or to do a pull request, these kind of things. But over time, if you do it like consistently after, like, it become easier and easier. So I would say, if you are new, you just want to contribute, check if there is a good first issue that interests you. If not, just use the product and find something to fix, basically.
Yeah. So we were talking before just about the episode I did with Kishin about Bitcoin in Japan and sort of the environment here for Bitcoin. You're based here. Are any of the other contributors based in Japan or
Of BTC Pay?
Yeah.
No.
I mean, you're based here. I mean, how are you seeing, obviously you were talking about DigiLab, your employer, and some of the other companies that we've mentioned, Mempool Space and a few others. How are you seeing the landscape for development in terms of what's happening in Japan, what's happening in Asia?
So in Japan, my main problem with Japan is that the Bitcoin community of foreigners and the one of Japanese is kind of split. There is not much mix. I think it's mainly a barrier language. I don't think there is really a solution to that. I guess it's something that happened in the other country as well. And Koji, for example, and Kishin is more connected to the Japanese community. Koji actually connected to both because he speaks perfect English, so he know very well, and Kishin as well, actually. But as far as I understood, it seems there is lots of people interested into using Lightning and like building stuff of Lightning. So there is some interests, but it's not really mixing too much with the international community.
Yeah,
I don't know if there is a solution to that.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting for me trying to explore that and understanding, you know, from Kishin's perspective what some of the challenges are, because certainly when we're talking about fiat, trying to run an exchange or any kind of on-ramp or off-ramp in Japan is very expensive, very difficult to do. It's difficult in a lot of countries, New Zealand as well, but certainly not to the degree where you need $500,000 just to get the license and all of this stuff, right?
And it's not like you give $1 million and they give you, it's like $500,000 and like cost. Working your ass off to put it down, like hiring the right people with the right connection, like putting, I would say, the bribe at the right place, they call.
And so I wonder if that sort of lays the groundwork, and what we were talking before about this situation with Stripe, you know, is there an opportunity for a kind of more decentralized, federated, perhaps payment solutions that are purely Bitcoin, and they kind of avoid all of that stuff, you know, because if you're operating your own node, you're running your own BTC Pay Server instance, you don't need the permission to do anything.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the ethos, right?
Yeah. I think we already have like a Lightning that worked reasonably well. I just feel like in Japan and all around the world, always the problem is local adoptions. And for local adoption, you need like a kind of Bitcoin service provider, somebody that know very well about Bitcoin, knowledgeable, that can go on Twitter, ping the right people, and have this kind of people that handhold normal business. And we don't have that in Japan. I don't think we have like that in lots of places. El Salvador, I guess, with Bitcoin Beach and things like this, they are doing that, as far as I understood. And I think that's a model that should work, but like, yeah, we need to make it easier to do that.
Well, it's also clarity. I mean, certainly it's challenging in New Zealand. You know, I'm involved with a few people who are trying to effectively, you know, encourage people to accept Bitcoin. It's a little bit easier in the sense that there's a lot of clarity in New Zealand around some of the tax implications. Japan, I think there is some clarity, but it can be perhaps a bit unsure for people. You know, what do I do? But I think there is an opportunity. It's sort of an education piece. But coming back to Lightning, we're talking about this, and there was a lot of discussion around Lightning in Japan. They had the flea market a couple of or a month or two ago. And in terms of what you're doing with BTC Pay and your experience working with Bitcoin Core, what are you seeing in terms of the discussions around covenants, in terms of some of the proposals that are out there? What's your take? What do you see from what you're developing? What's useful?
It's very hard to reply for me because it's... so this type of discussion, I've not been very involved anymore because I'm more focusing on BTC Pay itself. And actually, Bitcoin is super huge. On my side, most of my day, I'm focusing only on my lane, you know, BTC Pay server. Some merchant that use BTC Pay server know Lightning better than me. So I don't have really any strong opinion on that now because simply I didn't have time to take my time to read what's the, you know, advantage of it, why people should be excited about it. So I don't really know.
Remind me again, when did BTC Pay server start?
2017.
Okay, so that would have come in with SegWit or prior to?
It came during the war with SegWit, and basically BTC Pay server was the first to accept SegWit. Like it was from day one, it was already supported.
Interesting. So you haven't really got any strong opinions about sort of what these next steps are. It doesn't really materially impact your guys' roadmap in terms of what you want to do?
Not really. Like we are in BTC Pay server, that's a part of the reason why we cannot project ourselves too far in the future. Is that there is so many things happening, and maybe somebody will use a new feature for Bitcoin for something that lots of people want, and and on our side, we are kind of follower in this sense. We are looking what other people around us are doing and try to connect as much as possible. So there is one thing in the Bitcoin community that is kind of interesting, is that we have lots of projects all around in open source, like everywhere, and because it's open source, everything can connect to each other. Rather than having a model where we have one big app that does everything, like instead everything is spread out. And we are trying to be mindful of what other people are doing and connect to them when it makes sense.
Yeah. What's the, I guess, the forum or the way that you engage or keep up to date with what's happening more broadly in the ecosystem? Like, is that like a rough process of just...
Yeah.
Seeing or?
It's rough process. So on my side, most of my tech news, I take it from a Bitcoin Ops newsletter. Like they are really great at providing summaries of both discussions. So I'm just looking this. I mean, our contributors as well are in contact with lots of people around in the community. People talk with each other, and at one point, you know, they say, "Oh, I really like this part, I don't know, this part of Noster, can we do an integration with it? Okay, let's do it and like see how it goes." So I have an example, for example, the payment by NFC, by NFCs with tapping. So actually it was just Cooks that see that, was it LNBit? Maybe it was LNBit that implemented that first, but basically he was talking with somebody, so that he was like, "Oh, okay, that's cool. I would try to make it in BTC Pay server," and it was a great idea.
Is that what we saw at the event where you had the cards? Yeah.
Yeah, so at the event, it was a bit more complicated than this. So payment by NFC, there is two ways of doing it. The easy way that everybody was doing it before, but the easy way was a bit insecure. In a way, if somebody, if the terminal that where you pay save your card, basically they can withdraw the card whenever they want. Mm. They can replay to pull the money. And during the event, I implemented bolt cards. So it's also kind of the same protocol behind it, but except that there is a small token that prevents replay attack.
Yeah.
But that's the small small difference, but yeah, basically it's kind of the same.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the Bolt card you mentioned.
Yes.
Yeah. And I got a Bolt card. I love it. It's quite fun. Interesting. So, you did that event in Shibuya around the time of Nostra Asia. Has Nostra played any role in what you're doing? Have you been following that
so work? So not yet. However, I've been kind of interested into what Nostra is doing. I during the conference, I saw a talk about Nostra Wallet Connect, I see that the Nostra community seems to create lots of cool app on top of Nostra. And it seems to me that if we BTCP server allow Nostra Wallet Connect integration, then both product can connect together and allow lots of things that none of us foresee before. So an example, last year during the Riga conference, Cooks took care of setting up the payment system in the conference, so to all merchants. And the conference didn't want it to keep fiat. So they didn't want it to keep Bitcoin, I mean. So when the payment came, the payment arrived to the node of the exchange and was forwarded directly to I don't remember, Shapeshift. It's not Shapeshift. It's not. It's another, I think, Float, or I don't remember whichever it is. But that would convert it into a USDT liquid token, basically. And this auto forwarding, like Cooks needed to create a plugin on BTCP called Prism. So it's really a plugin that say when you receive the money, send it to this destination. And the thing is that the Nostra community already have the plugin like this. So why should we need to develop that ourselves? If we were connecting to their protocol, the Nostra Connect wallet, then somebody that just wanted, they can just, connect the Prism of the Nostra community directly on their BTCP server node and then be done with it. So I'm kind of interested in trying to really integrate product between them. It's kind of an exponential combination of things you can do when you allow connection like this.
Yeah.
So yeah.
So with BTC Pay Server, have you been surprised by anything in terms of seeing the way merchants use it, seeing the different kinds of merchants that are utilizing it in terms of like real world transactions? Like, what are some interesting case studies that you've seen throughout the world?
I'm a bit biased, but I was a very interested to the use case of accepted payment in conferences, Bitcoin payment in conferences, and we like I said, we helped the Riga conference to accept Lightning, so all merchant could accept Lightning. And by doing this, what's interesting me the most is that we are developer, and sometimes we are not the user of what we're creating. So when we finally use our own stuff to try to help somebody else, then we find all the problems and like rough age. So I'm kind of interested into like supporting conference in the future like this, just as a learning experience from us, from eating our own dog food, basically.
Yeah, I was going to say dog food.
Yes.
yeah, that's interesting. So, I mean, do you see the emergence of almost support for just normal merchants to set things up?
So personally, not too much, because I'm living in Japan and Japan is not the best place to be in Bitcoin 4. And I think for those local merchant adoption, we always end up needing those kind of local community Bitcoin service provider that help them. Mm. It's very, and I always think it's important that those service provider are not a community effort, in the sense that it should not be like free. Like lots of, because when you have some free service,
You don't value it as much.
You don't value it and you cannot trust it. So it's kind of So I was kind of recently I was looking Reddit, procrastinating on Reddit, and there was one post on Reddit unrelated to Bitcoin, but it was saying, "Oh, what typically a rich person do that normal people don't do?" And one of the first reply was, "Oh, the rich person always make clear that he want to pay," and when you say, and if you say, "Oh, you don't have to pay," then it's free. For lots of people, actually, it's turned them off because they say, "Okay, if I don't pay, it means that you can bail out and I cannot trust you to deliver what I'm asking for." So I just hope that we manage to get those call services done.
It's a transaction, right? We would call it value for value, perhaps, but you pay someone to help you set something up. You can then trust, I hope, a little bit more that they're going to commit to that.
And the thing is that you don't feel bad asking as well. Yeah. When you pay, like you say, "Okay, I'm paying, so now I can ask them." And that's really something that is missing, I think, in Bitcoin.
How do you see that relationship between kind of, you know, free and open source software and then ultimately some of these things that require money to pay people? Like, what is the dance between those two? Because obviously you've got paid contributors,
yeah,
on your project. The project itself is free and open source. I mean, what are your just general philosophies on how that can work together?
Well, those local services, the nice thing is that they know the local language and they know the local circumstances. So knowledge in the world is kind of distributed everywhere. And like those local people, like they have local knowledge, they know the local culture, they know the way to present stuff to an audience that people maybe living like a few kilometer away can't. So as an open source provider, as open source developer, we cannot replace that because we have no idea where, on my side, I'm living in Japan. I have no idea how somebody living, I don't know, in Serbia, like accept payments. So the kind of the dance, I think, is like those local people, BSP, are connected to the, I would say, Twitter community, like a Bitcoin community on Twitter. They can follow the news about what's going on in Bitcoin. They can see there is new release. They can kind of know that the contentious point of the day. They can follow kind of complex instruction. So they have all of this knowledge plus the local knowledge. And on the us as open source, we're in contact through this channel with them. And on our side, we try to make most of the knowledge of our software accessible to those people. So another, for example, something maybe more concrete. So in BTC Pay Server, like to help those local people, another thing we are doing right now is creating training material. So
Is that the manual?
Yes.
Yeah, I should have
bring you one, but like right now it's redraft. But yeah, it's a manual, and we just want to give this knowledge, this material, and distribute it to those local people that might be able, for example, to translate them, to maybe change the cover, to personalize it to their own community. And I think that's how like we try to collaborate, basically.
Yeah. I mean, I am interested in how this works. I mean, the example a lot of people bring up is WordPress, and I mean, personally, I hate WordPress as a system to work with. But in terms of the accessibility, maybe, you know, 15 years ago, I guess you could say, of, you know, WordPress open source and then WordPress.com as a paid solution. I mean, the way those two things work together was quite powerful. And I mean, you see similar things with Linux. In terms of BTC Pay Server, though, is there anything like that on your guys' roadmap where your foundation is actually able to commercialize?
No, like there is a foundation need to stay non-profit.
I see.
Like it's not a company. I'm very happy when people build paid service on BTC Pay Server. So a concrete example in BTC Prague last conference, like the payment provider was in front of us. They were called LN Pay.
Yes.
And they were like accepting Lightning payment everywhere. And we were like, oh, we were kind of, oh my God,
they're using our stuff.
No, we didn't know actually what they are doing and everything. And one sales guy come to us and say, oh guys, what are you doing? And he say, oh, we are an open source payment processor. I say, okay. So then he go drinking something, or I don't know. And later the developers of LNP come to see us. Oh guys, actually we are a fork of you. Like we did a fork and like we customized for our own need and like we really like what we are doing and everything. And on my side, I'm very happy to see that. I would say I prefer when company take care of payments in a conference than us, because it's not our goal. Our goal is we are a non-profit. I like being able to dog food my own stuff, but if we want the Bitcoin to grow, like the work needs to be distributed.
I like that approach, and I think this is something I think about a lot as well. You know, like what is the role of even legacy institutions, for example? You know, there is a whole generation or several generations that have affinity for legacy financial institutions, and there is a brand there. And so in New Zealand, you know, what does it mean for one of the banks that people have grown up with to have a Bitcoin presence or to be involved in Bitcoin in some capacity? That's a conversation that kind of, it's still happening, but how does that relate? Because it's very much, it gets a lot of flack from certain parts of the Bitcoin world, and it feels like it's kind of fiat or it's not quite pure Bitcoin. And I think we're still trying to work out what those are, if you know what I mean.
I'm kind of the camp of saying everything is good for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
You know, even those old financial institution trying. So the ETF, for example, like I know like some people don't like it. On my side, I think everything is good for Bitcoin. Of course, it comes with potential danger. What happens if one day there is a contentious for coming, and this time it's not like the corporate of BitPay or like Coinbase that are against us, but it's BlackRock.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know which will turn out. But like, it's not something we can, I think, prevent.
Mm-hmm. So sort of lean into it and accept that a lot of different parties are going to be interfacing with Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, that's interesting. You
just need to make sure that not like one party get too much power, but I think at this stage it's still difficult to reach this situation.
Yeah, well, there is questions though around something like BlackRock, you know, sitting on all of that Bitcoin. But in terms of, you mentioned at the beginning that the block size wars were a moment that gave you a lot to think about. Maybe it was a bit scary for Bitcoin. Has there been anything else that has come to that same level of?
No, far from it. So it's I mean, recent drama in Bitcoin was about the fees rising up because of the ordinals, for example. And like some people in ordinals saying, oh, we need to bigger block. And when I see that, like some noobs like kind of worried about that. And I'm like, oh, it's like,
so you're not
it's
worried.
Not serious.
You're not worried about
anything. No.
That's interesting. I mean, certainly, as I said,
I mean, it's pain in the ass, of course, the fee go up, but like, compared to like the threats of the fork in 2017, like it's not serious. Nobody take them like seriously, so I think it's fine.
Do you think compared to that time, the way that Bitcoin is talked about in terms of the forums, the Reddit threads, the Twitter threads, has that changed much in terms of how information is shared, how people find rough consensus socially?
I don't know. Really this time there was this contention because of the SegWit and the 2 megabyte block. Since then there has been Taproot, but Taproot was not really like contentious at all. So I don't feel any contention right now.
I guess in terms of
maybe with the ordinary people, but it's just because it's annoying. But like,
I guess how were those conversations discussed? Because I think there is still, you know, you've got Reddit, you've got Bitcoin Talk, you've got the mailing lists, you've got these kind of delivery mechanisms for conversation. Has that itself changed, do you think?
So on my side, before I was a lot on Bitcoin Talk. After Bitcoin Talk, I started being on Twitter. And I think since I moved to Twitter, I think, when did I move in Twitter? Maybe before the blockchain world. So it was a kind of long time ago. It didn't really, I felt it change. I remember clearly Bitcoin Talk, because Bitcoin Talk was a kind of different format. Like, when people write it on Bitcoin Talk, it was like a fucking wall of texts about the philosophical implication of Bitcoin and stuff like this. And it was kind of different conversation. It was fun. There was everything in this channel, in this forum. There was a nice economic essay next to some scammer running a casino on the blockchain, whatever, Satoshi Dice, like shitcoiners. There were everything. It was kind of a funny place.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I'm really interested in the social mechanism and kind of coming into this year and off the back of some of these issues with ordinals. I'm really interested in how that rough consensus conversation takes place. You know, it seems like, you know, there was a bit more naivety perhaps in the old days, whereas now, you know, who knows? You know, there's so many more influences, there's so many more voices. How would you navigate, and I know you said before you're not super focused on that stuff, but how would you approach making a judgment on something like if I need to change my node or update my code, you know?
So on my side, on BTCP side, basically, when there is a new version of Bitcoin Core, we see that people run it without too much problem. We don't give second thoughts. We just update, like not taking too much.
And sorry, you've got Bitcoin Core included in BTCP.
Yes. Yeah. In our main deployment, like the most official deployment system. Yeah, we have it. So I don't give too much thought about that. If there is a big contention on a soft fork of Bitcoin, then I would start like digging, like seriously on why this matter. But if I don't see like any major disagreements, I'm just riding along basically.
So you delegate the finding of contention to the mailing list, to Twitter, to
these places? Yes.
And I mean, whose voices do you look at? I mean, are there particular people who you've been taking or that you see as, a guide for what to look for in terms of contentious changes?
I respect a lot Peter Will, Greg Maxwell, Peter Toad as well. So I guess lots of Bitcoin Core developer like I respect a lot. So if there is contention, then I will look their argument very closely. Yeah.
Do you think though, if there's contention within there, it likely wouldn't have made it to Core? So, is there outside voices that are also critical of Core that you're aware of?
I would say of Core that I'm looking. We can argue that Peter Todd is not really Core anymore. He didn't code it for a lot, but I still respect what he's saying. Even if I don't always agree with him, Greg Maxwell, same thing. Like he didn't code it for like super long, so it's not typically Core. Mm. I don't really look too much podcasts or anything like this. Yeah, in general, on my side, I know that other people are different, but on my side, it's really focused on technical people in the Bitcoin world.
Do you think there's a difference between some of those technical discussions and the big wall of text philosophy? Is there a difference between the technical discussions and kind of these economic philosophical discussions in terms of how, like what they mean and how they kind of connect? It's just a soft fork as opposed to this is what it means in 20 years kind of thing.
It's difficult to see long-term implications. So like the for example, there is at one point one topic, for example, I really disagree with Peter Todd was, is he think that as the subsidy disappear, then Bitcoin might not have enough fees to sustain enough security. And I think that's one of those topics where, like, you can try to project yourself in the future about the economic implication of it, but at the end of the day, I think it's impossible. Yeah. Nobody know what will be the future. Maybe it will be right and it will be dangerous, maybe not. Same thing, like, for example, people that say, oh, we need like some post-quantum computer protection. I'm like, what do you know? Do you say in 30 years it will break? Like, maybe in 30 years there will be a meteorite that fall on the earth and then everybody die. You just cannot predict this kind of stuff. So I think we should not try to go too far ahead of ourselves. Mm-hmm. Because, like, if we try to do something because if we try to change the code because something maybe might happen 50 years in the future, then you are changing a code maybe that might have an implication in the short term as well, and that you didn't see it. So yeah, it's hard. Like, when there is a new change in Bitcoin, I just look really if there is no like fundamental properties of Bitcoin that are touched. Like, I don't want Bitcoin to be I don't want Bitcoin to lose this main purpose. So I want it to be as fungible as possible. I want to be as portable as possible. So I'm looking at the fundamental property of money, basically. But like, I never saw really, except the blockchain war, that would increase the block size. That was really... So for example, typically the blockchain during the blockchain war, they say, oh, if we increase the size of the block, then the portability of Bitcoin become better, right? Because it becomes cheaper to send money around. So the portability of Bitcoin, that is a fundamental property of money, is improved. But the thing is that then you are trading this against the defensibility of money. If you have a money that you cannot defend, then it will not be money for long. So it's also a fundamental property of money. So you are trying to make a trade-off between those two. And my point is that I don't think we should take any trade-off. Like, who are you to know that, okay, this property, the portability, is better than defensibility? So I think if it's not possible to make a judgment call on this, I think nothing should be done. There should not be trade-off. So yeah, that was, for example, my point in the blockchain war was that, okay, there is a trade-off between both, and there is nobody that can take a decision about why one trade-off is better than another, then we should not do it.
Wow. I guess to that point, has your view on Bitcoin, I mean, you talk about Bitcoin as money, but as we move into these discussions around payment layers, and I mean, the bigger question is what is money? But in terms of payment layers and Lightning, do you have any sort of ideas around how that grows in terms of the relationship between base chain and layer two as kind of money, the portability of money, that sort of thing?
About those layers, my main concern is that lots of people are starting to... So when the term L2, layer 2, has been invented, it was clearly to show a form of Bitcoin, a form of using Bitcoin in a different way. So it was for Lightning, basically. The main appeal of Lightning is that you're really using Bitcoin. If you want to close your channel and pick up your Bitcoin, you can do it. So that was the intention of layer 2. And then the problem is that shitcoiner kind of tried to take this term to describe other things that like to change the meaning of L2. And lots of Bitcoiner actually are starting to conflate use this term in a way that was not intended at the beginning. So for example, Liquid. Mm-hmm. Liquid, some people say, oh, it's a layer 2. LBTC is layer 2. No, it's not layer 2.
It's like, a sidechain.
It's a sidechain. Like, whatever, if something can happen, like, then you don't have your money. Like, some people say, okay, Mtgox is was L2. No, it's not L2. It's like you cannot, if you cannot get out, you need my, so my rule of thumb, if you cannot get out unilaterally, then it's not L2. It's like a substitute of Bitcoin.
So speaking of that then, I mean, how do you feel about some of the conversations around Liquid? Do you see a use case for Liquid? What?
Yeah, I mean it's perfectly fine to use it. Like at one point I was kind of interested into the idea of sending Bitcoin on Liquid and using like confidential transactions to try to kind of break the link between the UTXO on the chain. And I think it's interesting. We can, like, people can use it. It's likely like cheaper. Maybe there is not so much, it's not easy to sell maybe, but they are free to use. But just, I don't like when people try to conflate it and saying, oh, it's like Bitcoin. It's not like Bitcoin. It's, you trust, like something can happen to Liquid and you don't get your money back.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if what you said about the terminology layer two, you know, that I see what you mean, because it isn't even really a layer two. It's using Bitcoin's inherent properties, two of two multisig, all of this stuff to create a system that can then be used to have a balance between a channel, right? Whereas something like Liquid, you're trusting however many custodians or whatever it is. There's like a number of these, that, you know, these trusted people that you're basically handing it over to. And the concept of layer two, I mean, it sort of doesn't, the word itself doesn't really give that sense that it is still absolutely Bitcoin. You know, there's no way to, you know, get more out of it than you put in, sort of thing.
Yes.
So, interesting.
Same thing for, to me, it should be considered, so Liquid, typically Liquid Bitcoin, I would probably trust better Liquid Bitcoin than I would trust wrapped coin. But I would put them in the same category. They're like wrapped Bitcoin or LBTC is a wrapped Bitcoin. It is, I think it's superior because you're not trusting only one issuer. So I think it's definitely better. But yeah,
it's a delivery mechanism. And if you had a choice between not being able to use Bitcoin and then being able to send some Bitcoin via Liquid, I mean, it is a pathway.
Yeah.
It's opt-in, you choose to use it. However, I see what you're saying in terms of building on that. It isn't really, I mean, you're trusting this group, and I don't quite know what the number is, but the key players, and a lot of them are corporate entities.
Yeah. And you need also to find how do you transfer to your Liquid, your LBTC to BTC. It's not like, I think you need a account on an exchange of one of the signers, basically, or something like this. Like, how do you get out of LBTC? I don't know. I never used it, so yeah. I can't.
Do you think, in terms of, I mean, we're talking about layer twos here, do you think there's any other technology in that space on the horizon? There's conversations about Arc and other things. Do you see any of those, or have you looked at any of those as options for layer two?
I didn't see any other, for now, I didn't see any specific layer two that seems worth it to my mind right now. I heard about Arc, but I didn't pay too much attention in Asia, so maybe I'm missing something here.
That's fine. I think it's quite early days with that. And I guess coming back,
I'm a bit interested into other stuff like Fedimint and Cashew.
Yeah.
Like, but same thing. Those Cashew and Fedimint. So especially Cashew, for example, I don't see what it has related to Bitcoin. Like, why do they need to have like some? I mean, I like those projects as a new way to make money. I think it's an interesting new form, but it's definitely not layer two as well.
Yeah.
But still interesting project, and I wish one day in BTC Pay we can kind of support this method of payments. Yeah,
and I guess, I mean, wrapping up the talk about Lightning, but what are you seeing in terms of self-custodial Lightning, the ability for people to run it themselves? I mean, what's your thought around the philosophy of that, and then also how it's actually being achieved in reality?
So it's difficult. It's difficult. To me, the only one that tried to make the best job at this has been Phoenix. From Async. But even that, it's kind of difficult. Like, if Async disappeared tomorrow, how do you get your money out of Phoenix? I know that technically they are not custodian, that's for sure. But if their service go down, then your money will go down as well. So can you say it's done custodian? Is this? I'm not convinced it is.
Yeah. So. I mean, even what do those words mean? I mean, we get into the definition of something, but I mean, even the words like KYC, depending on who you talk to, everything is KYC. But there is a strict definition legally of, you know, handing over your driver's license. That isn't quite the same as signing up with an email address, for example. Yes. But they all get conflated together. And same with custody, self-custody. Like, what do those words really mean? It's a lot clearer with on-chain Bitcoin.
Yeah. It's definitely difficult to be for sure. Like, what are the legal liability if Async go down and the person has money on the wallet? How can they?
Well, I mean, I had a situation. I mean, I was foolishly using Moon Wallet, MUUN, and it doesn't support RBF. And I didn't put enough fees on a transaction recently, silly me. And I thought, well, sweet, I'll just load it into Electrum and do RBF through that. But firstly, it didn't support RBF out of the box. And the way you recover your, you know, your seed, your backup from Moon, it's not even a seed phrase or anything. It's like you have to use this command line thing. And it basically, I had to wait for the transaction to...
But at least if there is a way, even if the technical way is like difficult, I think it's good enough. Like,
yeah, I mean,
it sucks. I agree, it sucks. But if technically it's possible, then after it's just a matter of if shit happened, then tools will need to be built. But yeah, it's possible at least.
Yeah, I think the issue there was, I mean, I could have always done child pays for parent, but I was certainly going to be in trouble if I didn't have that option. It would have been difficult. Yeah. Because there was no balance left on that wallet. Yeah. So it was all in flight. In the mempool. And I mean, that was something you mentioned earlier. So you're trying to roll out RBF for BTC Pay server. So I mean, how's that going? Because I'm a bit naive, but I thought RBF, everyone's using that. No, it's not that common.
No, I mean like,
so is it optional at the moment still on Bitcoin Core?
Yeah, like for example, in BTC Pay server, the wallet of BTC Pay server randomly put the transaction as RBF or RBF able or not. But even if your transaction signal RBF, it doesn't mean that the software you are using, it will allow you, provide you the option to take advantage of it.
Oh,
because you still need to put a button, you know, okay, you select this transaction and you do you click on RBF. You still have, you know, you need this kind of UI.
Yeah. So correct me if I'm wrong. So RBF, on the node level, that's still an opt-in with Bitcoin Core.
Yes.
And so if you haven't got that flag selected on, if you haven't got that activated on your node, you can't use RBF anyway, is that right?
No. So in Bitcoin Core, there has been, so 1 year before, I think, 1 year before, but like every transaction can signal or not if you can RBF or not. It's a signal, so it's a software that creates the transaction that decide this. Mm. Like, so typically in my case it's BTC Pay server. And recently, I think 6 months ago, 1 year ago, I don't really remember, but there is an option now at the Bitcoin Core level that say, oh, we don't care about the signal anymore. That you signal RBF or not, then your node would just replace the transaction nevertheless without taking care of caring too much about that. So if you really want your transaction to be easy to RBF, the best way is that you signal it, the software that creates the transaction signal it and provide the option with a button to take advantage of this. Mm-hmm. So it's the best way. Like on Bitcoin, on a BTCP server, when somebody installed BTCP server with our Docker deployments, the version of Bitcoin Core that we are using, we put the flag to not check about signaling. So even if your transaction is not signaled, or node, the node will still try to broadcast the transaction on the network. And some of them will say, oh, I cannot relay this transaction because it's not, it cannot be RBF'd. And some other will say, okay, it's fine, and reach some miner. So it's it doesn't really matter. I think at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter if you signal or not. The only reason on BTCP server we signal this, we don't care about the signaling or RBF, is because if a customer try to RBF your transaction, as a merchant, you want to know as soon as possible.
Yeah.
So when the transaction coming from the customer reach your node, you don't want to see that this new RBF transaction, like, you want to see it. So that's why we put this the flag to not care about it.
I see. I mean, because you want to know if they're going to try and pull out.
Yes.
Yeah, I see. Interesting. So we've talked about a few different things today, Nicholas. I really appreciate it. In terms of, 2024, you've shared a little bit about the roadmap for what you guys are working on. In terms of yourself personally, I mean, what are you looking forward to for this year?
Good question. I'm still interested into how the ETF will turn out, for sure.
You got any travel planned or anything like that?
I think Riga. I wished to do Riga and Prague conference this year at least. Mm. And I hope being able to help for accepting payments. And if we help, we always we want to document everything, not only for us but also for the community to see the problems that need to be thought ahead. I don't know. Like, I see lots of discussion on covenants, but like I said, I didn't pay too much attention. So one reason why as well I don't pay attention too much in advance is that it takes time to not only understand it, but then how to use this new feature for example, how it will improve Lightning. And it takes a lot of time to study that, to understand in detail why it's good or not. And if for some reason it doesn't happen because somebody has another proposal or like a substitute, then all the time that you spend trying to understand that is basically wasted. So yeah. That's why I'm like, okay, wake me up when it's getting warmer.
Patience.
Yes.
Is important. Interesting. Well, hey man, I really appreciate you taking the time to come and talk to me about this and share what you're working on. It's really cool to see some stuff happening here around me. And to just sort of see the community that we have here in Japan and sort of some of the projects that are going on. I hope you can do another BTC Pay Day and we can have a play around with some of the terminals and the NFC cards and all of that stuff. It was really cool. But thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening. I do hope you enjoyed the show. I am Cody Allingham, and that was the Transformation of Value. If you would like to get in touch, please send me an email at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com and I will get back to you.